Okay, we begin with salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Today is January 28th, 2012. Yeah, I have to begin with an announcement for those people who are listening in or watching long distance over the internet. You know that you're entitled to ask questions, but I have to ask those who ask questions to keep the questions short and relevant to the topic of the lecture. There are people who are in the class who write down the questions, and when some of you give very long, complicated questions, they have to devote a lot of thought to writing out the question, and so they can't follow the track of the discussion. And also, as I said, keep the question relevant to the subject. Please don't ask me to compare some Buddhist idea with cognitive psychology, neuroscience, astrophysics. These are subjects that I don't know. Okay, so today we will be taking sutta number 66. This is called the Discourse on the Simile of the Quail. Okay, and the sutta will take the form of a conversation between the Buddha and a monk by the name of Udai. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha was living in a place called Anguttarapan. I don't know exactly where that is, and there was a town called Apana, near a town called Apana. Okay, so then in the morning the Buddha goes into the town for alms. Then when he comes back, and after his meal, then he goes into a certain grove to spend the day. So he sits down at the foot of a tree for his meditation during the day. Then the Venerable Udai does the same thing. He also goes into the same grove, sits down and spends the day meditating under the tree. Okay, then while the Venerable Udai was alone in meditation, the following thought arose in his mind, that how many dukkha dhamma, that is states which bring suffering or painful states, the Buddha has removed from us, and how many pleasant or blissful states the Blessed One has brought us. He's brought us so many, or he's removed from us, or taught us how to remove so many unwholesome states or unwholesome qualities, and he's given us the way to develop so many wholesome qualities. And as we'll see, it seems that Venerable Udai was thinking such thoughts with specific reference to the rules that the Buddha had laid down regarding taking the meals or eating. Okay, so in the evening, the Venerable Udai goes to the Buddha, pays homage to him, sits down, and then he relates his thoughts. Okay, he just repeats the thought that occurred to him, and now he's going to elaborate. And he's going to do so, as I said, with reference to the regulations concerning food. So he says, "Venerable Sir, formerly, that's in the past, we used to eat in the evening, in the morning, and during the day." It's here called outside the proper time. This means in the afternoon. Okay, then there was an occasion when the Blessed One addressed us, and he said, "Please abandon that daytime meal." That would be the afternoon meal. And so Udai says that I was upset by this, and I was saddened, thinking that the lay people who prepare our food for us, they give us the best food in the afternoon, probably at lunchtime, maybe 1 o'clock or so. And so the Buddha asked us to give up this meal, and so we relinquish it, and we do so out of our love and respect for the Buddha, and out of a sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing. So we have three, even four qualities that are involved in this. Two are what we might call qualities that look up to the Buddha. That is love, this is prema, or devotion towards the Buddha, and respect, because we respect the Buddha's wisdom. And then once the Buddha makes that request, then we do so out of a sense of shame. It doesn't really mean what the English word shame means, but it's more out of a sense of conscientiousness and out of fear of wrongdoing. Since if the Buddha lays down the rule or makes this request of us, then we don't want to transgress against that request of the Buddha. Okay, so then we gave up the daytime meal and we ate only in the morning and in the evening. Okay, then sometime later the Buddha addressed us and said, "Give up that night meal too." And so again, Udai was upset, thinking that the Buddha is asking us to give up the more sumptuous of these two meals. But again, out of love and respect for the Buddha, and out of a sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing, we abandoned the night meal, which was outside the proper time. Okay, here the text is using a word. Oh, it's a word that occurs in one of the training rules. Vikala, the word kala means time, and vi here has a sense of separation. So what is outside the time or beyond the time? And so according to the rule that was eventually laid down in the Patimokkha, or the Code of Monastic Rules, it's improper for the monk to take food, what's called vikala bhojana, which means food outside the proper time. And the proper time for the monastic person to take the food is between what's called dawn break, or the break of dawn, and midday, the middle of the day. And so it's become the tradition, which is upheld quite strongly within the Theravada tradition, for monks to take their food only between the very beginning of the dawn or the morning meal, and then to finish their meals for the day before 12 noon, which during daylight savings time it can go up to 1 p.m. because the actual midday is then at 1 p.m. It seems to me, this is my own conjecture, that probably from the earliest period, the Buddha himself observed the practice of taking only one meal a day and going on alms round in the early morning once it becomes light, and then collecting his food, and then taking his food quite, you know, early in the morning. And I would assume that this was the general practice amongst the monks who were following the Buddha's example. And this is a practice that's still observed, this practice of taking just one meal a day among some of the stricter monasteries in, I know especially in Thailand, perhaps in Burma, in Sri Lanka, there are some monks who observe the one meal practice. And so they would go on alms round, usually starting maybe about 7:30 in the morning, 7:30. And since if they're living in a forest monastery, it might be some distance from the village or town, so it might be a half an hour, 45-minute walk. Then the alms round would be could take about a half an hour, 20 minutes to half an hour. Then they have to walk back half an hour, 45 minutes. So by the time they get back, if they start out at 7:30, it could be about 9 or 9:30 that they get back. And then they will lay out the, set up the table and everything, and then take the meal. And so they're finished with the food by 10 a.m. In most monasteries, it's now become traditional to have two meals in the day. Take the morning meal, usually about 7 a.m., and then to have the main meal of the day, 11:15, 11:30, so that it's finished by 12 noon. Okay, so I think this was the practice that the Buddha himself set up as a model that was observed by many of the monks. But there was not a rule laid down in the early period that one has to eat within those hours. So it seemed that there were monks who would also go on alms round for for lunch, and then another time going an alms round in the evening for dinner. And so I suppose that the Buddha, when he realized that this was taking place, he then laid down these rules successively. You see, not all at once. Perhaps he felt that it would have been too drastic for the monks who were taking three meals a day to suddenly cut down to one meal in the morning. So first he abolished the afternoon meal. Then when they had gotten accustomed to that, then he abolished the evening meal. Maybe the question comes up, what is the reason for this observance of taking only the meals only in the morning? It's not really based on any ethical reasons at all. There's no ethical reason that one can't eat in the afternoon or in the evening. I think there are probably several considerations that the Buddha had in mind. One is to teach the virtue of contentment, to be content with one or two meals a day in the forenoon. Another reason is to give the monastics more time. In those days, they didn't really do book study because they didn't have books, but to have more time for their meditation so that they don't have to go two or three times a day into the town, village or town, to collect alms food. But you just finish the meal business by the middle of the day, and then you have the rest of the day free for yourself, for your practice. A third reason is probably because the Buddha didn't want the monastic community to become a burden on the householders. Because in those days, the monks would go mainly get their food by going on alms round. And so if the monks have to come around two or three times a day, then people feel that it's, especially if the Buddha is traveling with a large company of monks, maybe, you know, a few hundred monks, and then lay people think, the Buddha has arrived, and now we have to prepare food for all of the monks. You know, three times a day, it becomes a big burden. But if they just go on alms round once a day, then they get enough food that sustain them through the morning, and it's no burden on the lay people. And then I think there's another reason which is suggested by the coupling in the sutta of Udayi's exclamation that the Buddha has helped us to remove painful or unwholesome states and has provided us with blissful and wholesome states. And that is that the act of eating is bound up a lot with craving, the craving for enjoyable tastes. And of course, craving is a subjective matter. You know, it's the attitude towards the food that one takes. But still, if one is constantly eating several times a day, then there's more opportunity for the craving for taste to arise. And this would be probably the case, especially with younger monks who have, I mean, this is naturally what happens, is that when one gives up sexual enjoyment, then the mind has to find some kind of enjoyment in something. And so what often becomes then the focus of attention is the food, the taste of the food. And that can set off a lot of craving and fantasies and hopes and expectations. There's a story that comes in the Vinaya Pitaka about there's a group of notorious monks in the Sangha. They're called the group of six monks, or actually the group who was led by six monks. And these are the perpetual mischief makers in the Sangha. Okay, and so there's a certain monk who has the responsibility for assigning meals when householders come and want to offer a meal to the Sangha. And there's a householder who is described as the householder who prepares delicious food. Sort of that's his designation. And he comes to the monastery and he says that he wants to offer a meal. He tells this to the monk who, the assigner of meals, and the assigner of meals knows that it's the group of six monks that they are next in the lineup to get the meal. So he tells the householder, okay, for your meal offering, you'll get the group of six monks. And when the group of six monks hear about this, oh, they're so happy. They start chatting with each other. Tomorrow we're going to be getting a meal from the householder who prepares delicious food. But when the householder who prepares delicious food knows that he's going to get these mischief-maker monks, he serves them with just plain, ordinary food. So they become very angry and upset. Okay, so anyway, so this would be an important reason is the Buddha to give the monk some way to control, or at least to regulate the craving for food. Okay, now in the continuation of this passage, Udayi explains some of the other reasons for some of the other benefits of avoiding especially the evening meal. He says that once it happened that the monks were wandering for alms in the thick darkness of the night, they've walked into a cesspool, fallen into a sewer or a garbage pit, walked into a thorn brush, walked into a sleeping cow, they met with hoodlums, and they were sexually enticed by women. And then he relates something from his own experience, that one time he was wandering for alms at night, and there was a woman who was, apparently she was standing outside washing a pot, and he must have been standing in front of the woman's door with the alms bowl. She was washing the pot. And then suddenly there was a flash of lightning. And she saw him standing there and she screamed out in terror, "A devil has come for me." You know, of course, he's standing there with a shaved head, with these ochre-colored robes, and just in the flash of lightning. And people are very superstitious, simple people in South Asia. And so then he explains that, "I'm no devil, but I'm a monk waiting for alms." And then that woman reviles him and abuses him and says, "It would be better that you get your belly cut open rather than prowling around for alms for your belly's sake late at night." Okay, so then Upali Udayi repeats the statement. Okay, now the Buddha is going to generalize from Udayi's statement and to show the importance of following the training with respect to the Buddha's advice about abandoning this. And we'll see that this is going to become, in a way, the theme of the sutta, the idea of abandoning or relinquishing or letting go. The key word here is pahana. Okay, so this key word is pahana, which can mean abandoning or giving up or letting go. And it's closely related, or often it comes paired with another word, patinisaga, which means relinquishing, relinquishment. And so the Buddha's teaching, you could say, at least in large part, is concerned with abandoning or relinquishing those things which are tied up with suffering, or which are causes of suffering. And so here the Buddha says, there are certain misguided men or foolish men who, when I say, abandon this, they think this is just a mere trifle, just a little thing. And then they say that the recluse, that's the Buddha, is too much exacting or being too scrupulous. And so they don't abandon what the Buddha asked them to abandon. And then they show discourtesy or disrespect to me and towards the monks who are desirous of training. And so for them, that thing to which they refuse to give up, even though it seems to be something small and trifling, but it comes for them a strong, stout, tough tether and a thick yoke. And now the Buddha illustrates this with the simile, which this is the simile that gives the title to the sutta. This is like a quail who has been caught in a rotting creeper. And the quail is afraid of injury, captivity, or death. Now the creeper is rotting, so it seems to be very weak. And so somebody might say that that creeper is feeble, weak, rotting, just a coreless tether. But in the case of that quail, because the quail is just a small bird, fairly weak, So even though the creeper is thin, weak, and feeble, but for that quail, it's like a strong, tough feather. And so that illustrates how when the Buddha asks the monks, give up this, when they don't give that up, then that becomes like a tough, strong tether for them. Okay, then the opposite case is given of those who, when they go, who were instructed by the Buddha, abandon this, even though they think that this is a mere trifle, but still when the Buddha tells them to abandon it, then they abandon it, and they don't show discourtesy to him or towards the other monks. And so that thing then becomes a feeble, weak, rotting, coralless tether. And this is illustrated by the simile of a tusker elephant, very strong and powerful, and it's tethered down, bound down by tough leather thongs. But that elephant is so strong that just by twisting its body, it can break those thongs and walk, go off wherever it wants to. Okay, so this illustrates those clansmen who, when they're, or those monks who, when they're told, abandon this, then they abandon it, and so then they can live at ease, unruffled, with mind as free as that of a wild deer. Okay, now the Buddha is going to move into a more generalized teaching about the qualities that lead to renunciation. We're going to see here a contrast between two types of people. Okay, on the one hand, we have first a poor, destitute man. He's living just in a little hovel, open to the crows. He has just, his bed is made out of wicker. What is wickers? They're like reeds which have been stitched together, I think. And for his food, he just has some grain and pumpkin seeds in a pot. And he has a rather, I'm sorry to say this, but the text says, one hag of a wife. Okay, so okay, so then he sees, one day when he's walking by the monastery, he sees a monk sitting in the shade of a tree. He's finished his delicious meal, and he's sitting in meditation, devoting himself to the higher mind. That means he's practicing samadhi or sitting in samadhi. And so this poor man, living under quite destitute conditions, thinks, how pleasant is the state of a monk? How wonderful is the state of a monk? Oh, if only I could shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe and go forth into the homeless life, that would be so wonderful. But even though he would have to give up just very rudimentary conditions, still he's unable to do so. And for this person, the Buddha says that hovel in which he's living, his bed made out of wickers, his food consisting of grain and pumpkin seeds, his hag of a wife, all of those things become for him a strong, stout, tough, unrotting tether and a thick yoke. Okay, so in the same way, the Buddha says that when I tell you to abandon this, and then you don't abandon it, then that becomes a strong, stout, tough, unrotting tether and a thick yoke. Okay, now comes the opposite case. Here we have a rich householder with great wealth and property, gold, granaries, fields, land, a number of wives. We have to remember in the Buddha's time, monogamy was not something which was universally observed. And he has a vast number of men and women slaves. Also in the Buddha's time, slavery was quite common. So this man might see the monk sitting under the tree, devoting himself to the higher mind. He thinks, how pleasant is the state of a monk, how wonderful. Then he thinks, let me shave off my hair and beard, put on a yellow robe and go forth from the house, home life into homelessness. And then he's able to do so. He's not bound down by his wealth, his property, his wives, his land, the number of slaves and servants that he has. So the quality or the capacity for renunciation, it's an inward and subjective quality. It's not determined by one's objective possessions. So actually during the Buddha's time, many of the men and women who became monks and nuns under the Buddha came from the upper classes, from the kshatriyas, the aristocratic class, from the Brahmin class, some from the householder class, or the mercantile class, some from the working class. The Sangha was open to people from all four social classes, but even those who were kshatriyas, princes, were able to go forth and become monks, monks and nuns. Even those who were Brahmins, well-established Brahmins, could go forth. So it depends on the inner determination and not the outer conditions. There's a little story that I heard when I was in Sri Lanka, which shows the kind of mind that's needed for renunciation, becoming a monk. There were two young boys, I'll give them Sri Lankan names, who called one Ravi, the other Sunil. Okay, when they're little boys, they're walking by, taking a walk, they walk by a Buddhist monastery. Ravi says to Sunil, when I grow up, I'm going to become a monk. Sunil says, may your wish be fulfilled. Okay, a few years later, they're in high school. They're taking a walk. They walk by the Buddhist monastery. Ravi says to Sunil, when I finish high school, I'm going to become a monk. Sunil says, may your wish be fulfilled. Okay, now they're in college. They're taking a walk together. Maybe they're back home on their summer vacation. They're taking a walk. They walk past the monastery. Ravi says to Sunil, when I finish college, I'm going to become a monk. Sunil says, may your wish be fulfilled. Okay, some years later, they're married, have children. They're taking a walk. They walk past the monastery. Ravi says to Sunil, when the kids are grown up and out of the house, I'm going to become a monk. Then Sunil turns to Ravi and says, if you want to become a monk, that's not the way to do it. And Ravi says, then how do you become a monk? Sunil says, you just stand here, wait here a moment. Sunil goes into the monastery. About 20 minutes later, he comes walking out. His head is shaved. He's wearing ochre robe. And he comes to Ravi and says, if you want to become a monk, that's how you do it. But don't get any ideas. Okay, so this is the section on renunciation. Okay, now the Buddha is going to direct the discourse to increasingly deeper, more inward levels of renunciation. So in paragraph 13, he starts by declaring that there are four kinds of people found existing in the world. Okay, first there's a person who is practicing the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions, to the relinquishing of the acquisitions. And here we have that word, I think I mentioned it in the last class. The word is upadhi. Upadhi are things that one acquires and takes upon oneself. As I mentioned last time, one might even translate this as assets, which can be understood to refer only to monetary possessions. But they're things that one takes and brings near to oneself and establishes as one's own possessions. And also the word upadhi sometimes is used in the sense of the subjective act of acquiring possessions. In that sense we could call it appropriation. So upadhi is both property in the broadest sense and the act of making something one's property, appropriation. And the commentaries explain upadhi being three kinds of upadhi. One is material possessions, those things that bring one pleasure, those things that one acquires in order to establish a sense of personal identity, a sense of owning, a sense of pride, and that one uses as sources of pleasure. That's the coarsest kind of upadhi. But then there is the inner upadhi, which are the five aggregates. So we take these five aggregates to be me, to be mine. So that's an act of appropriation. And then the third kind of upadhi is the defilements, the mental act of appropriation, especially craving and clinging, by which we, that mental state or disposition by which we take possession of things and cling them to be mine. And so the Buddha describes Nibbana, he calls it sabupatti patinisago. It's the giving up or relinquishing of all acquisitions. So when the Buddha describes this person as practicing the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions, to the relinquishing of the acquisitions, he's actually speaking about somebody who is practicing the way to Nibbana. And that will come by relinquishing. First one gives up for one who becomes a monastic, one gives up the material possessions. Then one gives up strives to give up the inner act of appropriation by which one holds to the five aggregates or any source of pleasure as being mine, I or mine. Okay, so now as he's practicing the way, this is like referring to the process of meditation especially, memories and intentions or thoughts associated with the acquisitions beset him. So thoughts start to arise about the pleasures that he might have enjoyed in the worldly life. Pleasant memories come up, thoughts of returning to the worldly life. And so he tolerates them. He does not abandon them, does not remove them, do away with them, annihilate them. A little too forceful. So such a person, the Buddha says, I call fettered, not unfettered. So because he doesn't strive to overcome these thoughts connected with acquisitions, those thoughts and memories become for him a fetter which is binding him down. And the Buddha says, why is that? Because I have known the particular diversity of faculties in this person. Okay, now the Buddha explains the second type of person. Okay, this is a person who's also practicing the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions. And when he's doing so, then these memories and intentions arise in him. But this person does not tolerate them. He abandons them, removes them, does away with them, and annihilates them. So it's quite natural in one who's practicing for these thoughts and memories about worldly enjoyments to arise. So the dividing road is whether one tolerates those thoughts and lets them continue to run through the mind, in which case they gather momentum and become stronger bonds, pulling one back to the worldly life. Or one makes the effort to overcome those thoughts, to dispel them, to abandon them. Okay, in such a person, the Buddha says, that person too I call fettered, not unfettered. That is, this person, he's not yet liberated. He's practicing earnestly and sincerely, diligently, but still the fetters are present within him. Even though this person, because he's practicing properly, he's working at cutting the fetters, we could say. It's like the difference between, let us say, one elephant, we use the Buddha's example of the elephant, is bound by a tight fetter, maybe a creeper. One elephant just lies down and lets the fetter stay there, but the other elephant uses his claw or his tusk to try to wear away the fetter that's binding, that's caught his leg. So, though they're both, when you look at them, they're both fettered, but one, the one who just lies down, sleeps, eats, drinks, doesn't make any effort to cut the fetter, is going to remain fettered. While the elephant that tries to wear away the fetter is eventually going to break loose and get free. Okay, now the third person is one who is practicing the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions. And as he's practicing, memories and intentions associated with the acquisitions beset him now and then through lapses of mindfulness. That is, this seems to be a person who's generally able to keep his mind well under control, who has achieved a high degree of mastery over the mind. But occasionally, his mindfulness slips, and maybe through contact with sensory provocative objects, but just through the natural flow of thought, memories about past enjoyments in the household life, nostalgia, glorified images of the worldly life arise in this person. But this person, because he's established a base of training, he's able, he knows the right method to apply in order to remove those thoughts. So the text says that the memories and intentions associated with the acquisitions arise now and then through a lapse of mindfulness. And so his mindfulness might be slow in arising. That is, he might let those thoughts run through his mind a few turns. But then he catches those thoughts. After two or three turns of those thoughts, he catches them. He becomes aware that these are unwholesome thoughts. These thoughts cause agitation. These thoughts have to be removed. And then he quickly abandons them, removes them, eliminates them, does away with them. And then the Buddha illustrates this with the example of a man who takes two or three drops of water, or who takes some water and lets two or three drops fall onto a hot iron plate. The drops of water, they fall through the air as they're falling. You know, they remain as drops of water. But as soon as they hit the hot iron plate, they sizzle and evaporate. The water is gone. And so the falling of the drops of water, that is like the thoughts arising in the mind because of a lapse of mindfulness. And when they hit the hot iron plate and evaporate, that's like the arising of mindfulness and the quick dispelling of those thoughts. So those thoughts don't persist. But the Buddha says, such a person too, I call fettered, not unfettered. Why is that? Because I have known the particular diversity of faculties in this person. So even this person who has a well-developed mind, who's able to dispel these unwholesome thoughts and memories, is still not yet eliminated the fetters. He still has the fetters, even though he's quite highly advanced in the training. But now we come to the fourth person, and this would be the arahat. So the Buddha says, here some person has understood that acquisition, this act of appropriation, of taking things and making them mine, is the root of suffering, and thus he divests himself of the acquisitions. He lets go of all of the acquisitions, and he is liberated in the destruction or extinction of the acquisitions. So this is the person who has overcome all craving and clinging. So he still has the five aggregates. He might still have some simple material possessions, but because he has eliminated all craving and clinging, it's said that he is free of acquisitions, liberated by the destruction of the acquisitions. And so the Buddha says, this person I call unfettered, or free from all fetters, not fettered. Why is that? Because I have known the particular diversity of faculties in this person. Okay, maybe at this point, before we go further, I'll ask whether there's any questions on anything covered so far. Richard.
Yeah, well, I Yeah.
The phrase, you know, the particular diversity of faculties in this person, if you keep up your time, can you say more about that? What does he...
Yeah, I have to say that's a little bit puzzling to me, that expression. The way I would understand it is, it seems to be that even though the text says I have known the particular diversity of faculties in this person, it seems to me that it makes better sense if we understand that his knowledge or of the diversity of faculties to extend over the four persons rather than applying entirely to each, but he understands the diversity of faculties in persons, so he knows that the first person has, you know, one, his faculties or spiritual faculties are of one level of development, the second person has more strong, highly developed faculties, the third person still more highly developed faculties, and the fourth person has completed the cultivation of the faculties. That's the way I would understand it.
Okay, that is, if you're reading it that way, do you think that it would come out this way in the text as a product of the process of memorization?
As a product of the process?
Of memorization, because each of the, you know, there's the use of lots of repeated phrases.
Yeah.
There is an epic poetry.
Yeah.
To enable people to remember better.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether a tagline like that is used four times instead of once, because it facilitated the monk's ability to memorize it before it was
written down.
Yeah, that is quite possible.
Thank you.
Yeah, it could be that. I mean, to my recollection, the text does say, in this person, imasmin pugale, I think. But, you know, it could be that the original idea was simply that I have known the particular diversity of faculties in persons. Perhaps that could have been the original sense. And then somehow, because the texts were edited as well, and so it could be that in the process of editing, that phrase got repeated in the case of each person. And it could be also that this is the original wording of the discourse, and I just don't understand it properly. Okay, somebody asks, when listing the reasons the Buddha limited the meals for monks, you referred to regulating craving. Is it also possible to say that the Buddha had in mind forcing the monks to deal with their cravings? Not to make the Buddha sound like a masochist. I think he means a sadist. Well, naturally, when meals are limited, then you do have to face one's craving, because there'll come the recollection of, you know, the delicious dinner that one had, now one has to give it up. I don't think that the Buddha, though, was maliciously attempting to put the monks into a hole and force them to face their craving in that way. But his intention was to help the monks regulate, as I said, control or regulate the craving, and just as part of the natural part of the process of dealing with one's craving, the craving will arise and then one has to face it and try to overcome it. I mean, from personal experience, I did go through this during my early years as a monk. You know, you start, because you have this long stretch of time, you know, from 12 noon till the next 7 a.m. the next morning, and the Sri Lankan cooking is very delicious spices, very pungent curry flavors, and sometimes people are cooking in the houses, and then the smell of the food being cooked, the wind blows it up the hill to the place where I was living, and the smell, I realize, not for me tonight. Yeah, so one does have to deal with it. Interesting.
I have a question about appropriation
of
property. What if...
I find myself thinking that story you wrote about your friend who was an artist. If it wasn't an exterior piece of property with a talent. It seems to me that in his case, when you wrote the story about your friend, who it's relinquishing attachment to a gift or a talent rather than giving it up and repressing it. Because he continued to paint and draw. But without an attachment to, you know, this is me and I'm a great artist and I want to be famous. I'm just wondering how you see appropriation. It seems like the important point is non-attachment.
Definitely the case, I mean, we do have, in a sense, property. Like if anybody tries, just when we came down from Taisho Hall, I locked the door, Venerable came around and looked at me a little surprised. So I said, better to lock the door than to come back and find that the computer is gone with years of work disappearing, right? Okay, any further questions? Okay, then let us move on. Okay, now the Buddha is going to contrast two kinds of pleasure. And then he's going to use this as a takeoff point for guiding us into successively higher and more subtle states of exalted or developed consciousness. Okay, so first he begins with what are called the five chords or five types of, or five objects of sensual pleasure. These are delightful and agreeable forms, sounds, odors, flavors, and tactile objects. So those are the five chords or five objects of sensual pleasure. And then the pleasure and joy that arise on the basis of these five chords of sensual pleasure, this is called sensual pleasure. And now the Buddha is using rather strong language here, but you have to remember that he's speaking to renunciants, and sort of the purpose of this is sort of to emphasize the need to overcome the attraction to these types of sensual pleasure. So he says, I call this a filthy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, and an arya, an ignoble pleasure. And I say of this kind of pleasure that it should not be pursued, not developed, not cultivated, that it should be feared. This is especially for renunciants because it's the attraction to sensual pleasure that brings one back from the life of renunciation to the life of indulgence. Okay, now the Buddha contrasts this with the pleasure or the bliss of meditation. He speaks about the attainment of the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. So these are the four jhanas. And then he says that this is called Nekama Sukha, that's the bliss of renunciation. Paviveka Sukha, the bliss of seclusion. Upasama Sukha, the bliss of peace or quiescence. And Bodhi Sukha, or Sambodhi Sukha, the bliss of enlightenment. Even though the jhana itself is not the state of enlightenment, but this bliss of the jhana will lead to enlightenment. And so then he says, of this kind of pleasure, I say that it should be pursued, should be developed, should be cultivated, should not be feared. Okay, now he's going to take us successively through the jhanas again. Again, he speaks about the monk who enters and abides in the first jhana. But now, even though previously he praised the first jhana, but now he's going to point out a fault even in the first jhana. He says that, I say that this belongs to the perturbable. The word he used here is injitam. Something that this, even in the first jhana, there's some element of, you could say, disturbance, of perturbation, though it's very subtle. And then he'll explain, what is it in the first jhana that belongs to the perturbable? He says it's the applied thought and sustained thought that have not yet stopped within the first jhana. So the first two factors of the first jhana, the factors that are actually used to attain the first jhana, are the application of the mind to the object, that is applied thought, and then the observation of the object, the examination of the object, that is called sustained thought. And even though the first jhana is elevated far above the ordinary sensory consciousness, because applied thought and sustained thought, vitakka and vichara, are present there, those factors create a very slight degree of disturbance or perturbation in the consciousness. Okay, but now the Buddha goes on and takes us to the attainment of the second jhana. This comes with the abandoning of applied and sustained thought. One enters and dwells in the second jhana. But even this belongs to the perturbable. There's some disturbance in the second jhana. And what is that disturbance? It's this piti, the rapture, and the pleasure of the third jhana. Because that rapture, it's a kind of exhilaration of the mind, exaltation of the mind. So the mind is uplifted, joyful. But that joy, even though it's a very pure, non-sensual type of joy, very sublime type of joy, but it creates the basis for a subtle clinging and attachment. So that belongs to the perturbable. Okay, the next step, the monk or the practitioner strives to overcome the rapture. And when the rapture fades away, he enters and dwells in the third jhana. And this, the Buddha says, this also belongs to the perturbable. And what belongs to the perturbable there? He says it's, I think this is not the correct translation, it says the pleasure of equanimity. But I think it might be more accurate to say that it's the pleasure of the pleasure and equanimity that has not ceased there. From the Pali, it's difficult to know exactly how to resolve that. Supeka sukha. But anyway, within the third jhana, there's still a pleasant feeling, a feeling of a blissful feeling. And that blissful feeling becomes a subtle object of attachment. And so that subtle bliss of the jhana involves some degree of disturbance, very, very subtle, extremely refined, but it's still an element of disturbance. Okay, so the monk or the practitioner goes further and abandons pleasure, the pleasure of the jhana. The pain and the other feelings have been abandoned earlier, and so he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana. And the fourth jhana has a feeling which is neither pleasant nor painful. It's called the feeling which is neither pleasant nor painful feeling. It has the perfection of mindfulness, and it's accompanied by pure equanimity. And so the Buddha says here, he says, this belongs to the imperturbable. This is called in Pali anenja. Okay, so that is the first stage of the imperturbable. Okay, now the Buddha again goes back to the first jhana. We're in paragraph 26. So the monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, and the Buddha says, this, I say, is not enough. Abandon it, overcome it, go beyond it, transcend it. And what transcends it? The monk enters and dwells in the second jhana. Again, the Buddha says, that is not enough, go beyond it. He enters the third jhana, that is not enough, abandon it, go beyond it. He enters the fourth jhana, not enough, go beyond it. Then, beyond the fourth jhana, lie the four formless meditations. First, the base of the infinity of space. He attains it, masters it. The Buddha says, not enough, go beyond it. Abandon it, go beyond it. Going beyond the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness. Again, not enough, abandon it. Go beyond it. Actually, one doesn't really abandon it because the meditator will still be able to attain those states. But in the practice, he has to go on to the next higher stage. So beyond the base of infinite space is the base of nothingness. Again, not enough. Abandon it. Then comes the fourth and highest formless attainment. That's called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But again, the Buddha says, that is not enough. This is inadequate. Abandon it. Surmount it. Go beyond it. And what lies beyond the base of neither perception nor non-perception? Here the monk enters and dwells in the cessation of perception and feeling. This is a meditative state in which all perception and all feeling have ceased and are absent. Okay, then the Buddha says, that surmounts it. Thus I speak of the abandoning even of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And then the Buddha sort of sums up the whole point of the discourse by saying, do you see, Udayi, any fetter, small or great, of whose abandoning I do not speak? And then Udayi says, no, Venerable Sir. And that's the end of the discourse. I should just explain very briefly that, at least according to my understanding, to reach the final goal of liberation, it's not necessary to go through all of these stages, the jhanas and the formless attainments. Here it seems the Buddha is speaking with reference to the person who becomes what is called the two ways liberated arahant. But other texts that we'll come to in our next semester speak about two ways to achieve arahantship. One is the person who masters the eight meditative attainments with the nine attainments and then achieves arahantship through wisdom. So that is the two ways liberated one, because he's mastered all of the stages of meditation as well as liberated from samsara through wisdom. The other type of person is called the wisdom liberated arhat. This is one, he could achieve the four jhanas, but doesn't necessarily go through the formless attainments. So he achieves one or another of the four jhanas, and then through wisdom, he becomes liberated without mastering the formless meditations. Okay, if there are any questions, then please. It's good if you take the mobile number.
Hello? Yeah, I would like to know, I understand the jhanas are different ways of being seen. I understand the way he explains it, but from the way I've read in books and explained by other monks, they state that when you go to a first jhana, it's supposed to be certain, light, for example, like a pearl. And as you go to the fourth, you can see a blue light, more or less. Would that be, right? Or is that something that some people will see in some way?
Okay, this is the way the jhanas come to be explained in works like the Visuddhimagga and the commentaries. They speak about a nimitta. This is called a nimitta, sometimes translated a sign or a mark, which is said to be the object of the mind as it's moving towards the jhana. We don't find such explicit mention of things like the nimittas in the early suttas.
The suttas, right.
But the jhanas are always explained with reference to the factors of consciousness that are present. And it seems to me that the nimittas, some people see them, some people don't. Maybe with certain meditation objects, the nimitta will appear, with others, they won't appear.
Thanks.
Okay, somebody asked, can the four kinds of persons, that's the four that we saw on page 556, be interpreted by way of four levels of mindfulness? Yeah, I think that's a good point. We could say that the four represent four different stages in the degree of development of mindfulness. But maybe not just mindfulness alone, but probably this is what the diversity of faculties is referring to, because there are five faculties, the faculties of faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Presumably, the first three, it seems, haven't yet reached the stage of developing samadhi, concentration, and wisdom, but we say that there are different stages in the development of faith, energy, and mindfulness.
Well, I think I cannot distinguish the second type of people from the third type of people. What's their difference?
Okay. I have to say they're very, very close. I could only offer a conjecture. that the second type is one in whom these memories and intentions associated with the acquisitions arise fairly regularly. And so the person's faculties are not yet well developed, but the person, whenever these kinds of thoughts and memories arise, the person makes the effort, the diligent effort, to remove them. So the person is still repeatedly beset by such thoughts and memories, but the person is diligent in their practice. In the case of the third person, what I would assume is that the person has made substantial progress in overcoming those thoughts and memories. So for long periods of time, those thoughts are absent. You know, so the person might have clear, calm, peaceful, even perhaps a mind of samadhi much of the time. But occasionally when the mindfulness relaxes, and then when there's a certain stimulation, that person will, those kinds of thoughts and memories will arise in the person. Maybe this is illustrated by a case. It's mentioned in the Visuddhimagga, a monk who thought he was an arahat, and so he must have been very free from disturbing thoughts for even for years. But then his pupil, who was a real arahat, realized that he had not yet, his teacher had not yet reached real attainment. And so he came to his teacher and he told his teacher, "Do you have psychic powers?" The teacher said, "Yes." Then you can, can you, with your mind, create an image of a beautiful woman, a young girl, about 18 years old, with very beautifully dressed, with nice flowing hair? The teacher said, "No problem." Created the image of that beautiful young girl. And suddenly, as the teacher looked at him, at her, his face turned red. Then his pupil said, "What thought arose in your mind?" Then the teacher realized, "I'm not yet an arahant." And then he begged his pupil to give him some instruction. He practiced, and he reached the attainment. Okay, we'll take one more question, and then we'll stop and then come back after the lunch. Somebody says, "What do you mean by four levels of mindfulness? I know only of the four foundations of mindfulness." Actually, it wasn't me who originally used the expression four levels of mindfulness. That was the other person who asked the question. But what I mean is four levels in the strength or persistence of mindfulness. Four levels of strength and consistency of mindfulness. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits, and then we'll come back for a discussion about 12, a little after 12. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the fear spirits, the dragon spirits, asking them to rejoice in the merits, to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Pavagopadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, so we will have a class next Saturday, February 4th, and we'll take next Saturday Sutta number 67. That's the Chaturma Sutta. Okay, thank you for your attention.
We end with three bows. Been unmindful this morning. I didn't take the clang of the chime. Okay, you could just hit it. You just hit it.
Out of funding.